Made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. Programs on WILL are made possible by Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design in downtown Champaign, featuring Opals from the Outback, a series of gemstone roundtables to benefit WILL on October 7th, 8th, and 9th. More information is available at 352-2415.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Afternoon Magazine. This is Carol Spindell, and I'm sitting in today for Celeste Quinn. And today we're going to be talking with Sarah Erdman. Sarah Erdman is the author of Nine Hills to Nambokaha, 2 Years in the Heart of an African Village. Sarah, welcome to Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you. To tell listeners a little bit about your experiences and about the book, Sarah spent 2 years in a Sanufa village in the northern part of the West African nation of Ivory Coast. She was there with the Peace Corps. They sent you there to be a health worker. Mm-hmm. One of the first people that you meet when you go into the village of Nambokaha, and one of the first people that you describe in detail, is the local nurse. Mm-hmm. There is a clinic in the village run by this nurse, and his name is Sidibe. And it seems to me, reading the book, immediately I was struck by the fact that you had really great good luck to end up in a village in which he was the nurse. Did you feel that way?
Absolutely. Actually, there was a workshop at one point during my Peace Corps tenure in which all the health workers got together with all their nurses, and we did a lot of trainings together. And I remember leaving that workshop and all the other volunteers saying, "Wow, you are so lucky." he was dynamic and really motivated and fun to get along with, easy to get along with. And yeah, I was absolutely very lucky. Some other volunteers had as good a friendship as I did with Sidibe with their nurses, but he really was kind of a gem in the village. The villagers themselves loved him so much, and that was really helpful, because in some of the other areas, the nurses weren't loved by their villagers. They were seen as sort of elitist outsiders who had just come in to introduce modern medicine, which was a little bit scary. But Sidibe took great pains to make the whole medical field and the whole idea of going to the infirmary a lot less intimidating. So he was really wonderful.
Well, in the book, we get to spend a lot of time with his family, with you, and in his courtyard. And right away, I was struck by several remarkable things that he does, because he's not your typical African village male. He eats with his wife, mm-hmm. and he won't slaughter animals, which is typically a man's job in a Sanufa village.
Yeah, he was very much a thinker, and he had sort of laid out his own personal totems, as they call them, totems, like taboos. He decided early that he wasn't going to harm things, and so he would always send over the evening meal over the wall to the neighbor to have the slaughter. And I don't know exactly why he didn't do it. It's not like Islam forbids it or anything. It's just I think he was a very gentle soul, and that just sort of was illustrated in his reaction to animals. At the same time, my dog, who also spent a lot of time at their house, was always well treated by Sidibe. The kids hit him all the time, and Abi, his wife, certainly hated the dog. But you could see it with Sidibe. He considered the dog sort of his friend, and that was unusual in a village as well, where dogs are generally seen as just animals to kick around. And yes, he did eat with his wife, which is such a refreshing thing to see. It was a traditional village, and so most of the other villagers, in fact, all of them, I think, ate divided by the sexes. And Sidibe, my nurse, was very good with his wife, was very, very sort of modern, I suppose, and liked to discuss things with her, and so they would always do that over the meal, and it just, it struck me, too, as in the beginning it was normal, and then as I, you know, got to know the rest of the culture there, it struck me that it really was unusual.
But it seems like, in a way, I mean, he's a master at navigating these complications because he has to get along with the villagers, he has to placate the chief, and you say at one point that he kind of hides the fact that he values his wife's opinion and eats with her and consults with her.
Mm-hmm. At one point, I think in the book, I said that he's a man that has his foot firmly, one foot firmly in the modern world and the other foot in the traditional world, and I think one of the things that he had to do to keep that strange position was just, you know, hide one foot from the other many times. So when he was in the modern world, you know, he wouldn't talk about some of the traditional things that he took on or, you know, the fact that he was supporting his brother and his brother's wives as a traditional African should. But when he was in the traditional world, he certainly didn't talk a whole lot about the more modern elements of his life as well. So, yeah, I think he's an interesting symbol for much of Africa, actually, that's sort of teetering between the two, the traditional culture and modern influences and the modern value systems. And he really did have to sort of decide how he was going to approach each decision he made and how he was going to, you know, make public the decisions he made so that he didn't offend anyone or alienate anyone.
Well, you also explain the economics of his family situation, and I thought that also just made so clear the position that so many Africans who are successful, because he certainly is successful in his own culture's terms and in village terms, mm-hmm. And yet, he's in a very complicated situation in terms of his economics. He
right.
and his wife have decided to only have 4 children, which is remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you could talk a little bit about that, about his obligations to the extended family and
mm-hmm.
his efforts to make this economic situation work.
It's interesting because I think it's something that really helps African communities and also really hinders them. The fact is that Sidi Bey's brother, his older brother, no less, was not financially solvent. He was a moped repairman, and that sort of work did not give him enough money to support his 18 children and his 2 wives. And because of that, Sidi Bey was always sending money down, sending rice down, taking care of some of his brother's children. And so because I think that helped the families get along and helped his brother's kids go to school, and that's positive. You know, the community is always out there helping each other. The families are always taking care of each other, and that, I think, is one of the biggest, the most impressive things about African society, at least West African society, that I could see, is just that people really support each other. But at the same time, they do it at the expense of their own comfort sometimes, or getting ahead themselves. And so, yes, he had made great decisions. He had decided to work with family planning and to only have 4 kids himself. He had done well for himself as a nurse as much as he could. I mean, he was basically dependent on the state state paychecks, and they didn't always come, and they never increased. He had the same salary the full 2 years I was there, and apparently for a dozen years beforehand, he had never gotten a raise. So, but nonetheless, he was working on the side to try to make money as well. So he had made some really shrewd decisions, but at the same time, he was held back to an extent, I suppose, by the idea that his family knew that he was doing well, and so they expected him to take care of them.
Well, let me say that this is Carol Spindall. I'm sitting in today for Celeste Quinn on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with Sarah Erdman, author of 9 Hills to Nambakaha. And if listeners would like to join in with a question or a comment, locally you could call 333-9455, or if you're out of our area code, 1-800-222-9455, and we welcome you in the conversation. Now, when you arrived in this village, Sarah, it seems like your position, your job, was pretty ambiguous. The Peace Corps hadn't really told you what to do.
Right, right. And they never do. And I think that's one of the sometimes one of the big myths about Peace Corps. It's very hands off. They'll train you. They'll give you all the tools that you need to do your work, and they'll be a constant resource. But they don't know the community. They know enough about it that they feel confident to send a volunteer there, but they haven't done any of the legwork, and that's up to you. And that's a huge part of development, is the needs assessment, is doing the analysis of the community and deciding with the community what is needed. And so it's kind of like an abbreviated tutorial in how to do development work, because we got to these villages. The villages were open and ready for us, but only, you know, in a welcoming sort of way. They knew that they needed a house for us. They knew that for me, but for each village, you know, had their own volunteer. They knew they needed a house. They knew that I was going to be doing something with health. But after that, they really didn't know much at all. And it was up to me to explain what I was doing there. And it was up to me to make the contacts in the village and start in those first couple months to discuss health and what is missing in health education or in health, in the clinic even, or just in the health situation of the village. And it's actually quite helpful, I think, in the end, to go in without an agenda, because it really helps you shape your programs to the specific needs of the village. So Peace Corps had given me ideas of what I could have done. In fact, the Healthy Baby Contest that ended up being a major part of the health work that I did. It sounds so silly to have a healthy baby contest, but actually it was a huge success, in which many illiterate women got trained in really important health topics that they were facing. So Peace Corps had mentioned things like that, and then you take their basic ideas and you add to them and you develop them for your specific situation. So, no, Peace Corps had not prepared me for the village of Nambonka, but they had prepared me to do health work in a rural African village.
Well, one thing that Sidibe tells you very early on, and I think you observe as well, you're watching and trying to figure all this out, trying to figure out what you could do to help, you see immediately that villagers are reluctant to go to the clinic, and they often don't go until their illnesses are very serious.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be a big block, a big obstacle for both Sidibe and for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a challenge on a couple different levels. First of all, just monetarily, the villagers didn't have a lot of money, and they weren't used to turning to modern medicine and spending money on that. They traditionally could go to their healers, the village healers, and get some indigenous medicine or indigenous treatment to take care of their ills. Whether or not they actually took care of them is a different question. I think some were successful and some were not. But they were much more likely to go to a healer to get a basic traditional cure because it was cheaper than to go to the nurse, where they did feel a little bit, regardless of all of Sidibe's welcoming attitude, they did feel, I think, a little bit nervous about the fact that there were needles there and mysterious pills. And it was this strange sort of dichotomy, a constant struggle between whether or not you trust modern medicine or you believe in the miracle pill. And so, you know, people would come to me and say, oh, don't you have a pill for my sick daughter? And they would want me just to give them a pill, and the pill would cure everything. But at the same time, if it meant going to the hospital and getting paying for treatment, it was something they weren't excited about doing. So it was still, again, the sort of fight between modern and tradition, or the constant contrast between those two. And they were getting used to it to a certain extent. But the other side of it is also just the fatalism in the village, and the fact that a lot of them felt that, you know, a sickness is controlled by curses and witches and Allah, and if somebody is chosen to be sick and to die, then that's the way it goes. And so it wasn't all the time that they felt that it was their place, I think, even to try to heal somebody.
Well, then you come upon the wonderful idea of the Healthy Baby Contest. And it turns out Sidibe has a scale in his closet.
Right.
And you start weighing babies, and pretty soon you've got assistants, and it happens at the market, and mm-hmm. women start getting excited about it. Tell us about the Healthy Baby Contest.
Well, it was we started out just as a baby weighing outfit, and we had thought about this. A couple of my friends in the village and I had thought about doing something that promoted preventive health care in the village, because nobody did anything to stay healthy. They just worked on curing illness. So this was the first time that they had ever done anything that might prevent sickness in the first place, except for vaccinations, which did happen once a month. So we started the baby wing program. CDBA found the scale, all spider, covered in spider webs and rusty and sort of jingled every time you walked anywhere with it. And we cleaned it up and built a table, and I built a measuring board and painted it with nice acrylics. And we set it all up in the village market. And the women were excited about it the first day because we combined it with a vaccination day. And so all the women who would come to get vaccinated were told, you know, come and weigh your baby, too. And it was kind of this new, exciting thing that you could do. But it died down after a little while. We had a couple small snafus, like babies peeing on the measuring board and my poor acrylics running all over the place. But it took a little while to catch on. It probably about 6 or 7 months after we began weighing babies did women actually start to consider it a routine part of village life. And it was really exciting. I'm not exactly sure what turned the tide, because I remember leaving the village for a couple weeks to go on Christmas vacation and coming back and finding just lines and lines of women waiting to weigh their babies. So it was sort of a coup and very exciting. And then we decided we needed a way of making it not just a fancy, but more of a habit. And so we started this baby weighing this healthy baby contest. And the contest was based on several different activities or actions that the women had to take. And one of them was getting regular vaccinations. The other was coming to weigh regularly. The third was coming to monthly courses that we would create based on some of the health issues that they were dealing with. And the last was just to have a healthy baby. And these women came. They were amazing. They were illiterate women who spend most of their days by the fireside cooking meals for their husbands and going to the fields with all those meals and working all day long and then coming back and cooking more. And cooking, of course, means pounding corn from kernel to flour. I mean, they were just incredible women, and they took time out of their day to come to these courses. And they were an amazing success. They were great at it. It was such a great thing to see these women who you think of because of their physical prowess, because they can pound this corn and pump this water and work these fields day in and day out. But in fact, they were just waiting for something to wrap their minds around, too. And this was it. And it was wonderful. We had courses on home remedies, courses on how to avoid malaria, courses on breastfeeding and weaning, courses on STDs and HIV and AIDS, on family planning, and they were so excited about it. And in the end, we ended up awarding the women that had completed all the steps of the contest 6 months later. And there were many of them, and they were very proud. So it was a really exciting way to sort of show the villagers that the worth of their women. I think they did honor their women in many ways, but intellectual ability was never something that they considered them for. So it's pretty amazing, an amazing event.
Well, it's a wonderful story, the Healthy Baby Contest.
Thank you.
It's really, I enjoyed it a lot. It starts off and you just don't know how this is going to go, but it just builds and builds. And then the sort of exuberance of Bakari and Draman, the two young men who are helping you. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful story. And
it's great to see. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned HIV and AIDS, and of course, over here we know that AIDS is an enormous problem in sub-Saharan Africa. But I think until we read something like your book, we forget how common death is in a village, how mm-hmm. common it is for people to die of diseases anyway. Mm-hmm. And it's hard, I think, too, for us to understand our culture is so inundated with sexual references, mm-hmm. how very modest and prudish African culture is. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that 50% of the prostitutes in Abidjan, the capital city of Ivory Coast, are believed to have been to be infected in a study. And yet, there you are in this village, and it's very difficult to talk about AIDS.
It's I think it's becoming less difficult, but it very slowly. There's quite a remarkable difference between the southern part of Cote d'Ivoire and the northern part. The southern part has a lot more exposure to education, to television. And their culture, they're largely Christian as well, so they don't have as many of the taboos surrounding discussing HIV and AIDS or sexual relations. They still do have taboos about telling who actually is infected because there's such a stigma associated with it. But there was a lot of education and outreach programs going on in the South, and that was a really great thing to see. In the North, it was just coming. The NGO that I hired to come and talk to our to the village on our HIV and AIDS Awareness Day had never really done programs in the North. They were a brand new branch, and so the North hadn't really been affected quite as much as the South, and because of that, they hadn't gotten the outreach either. But it was very important to get them to, you know, to start talking about it immediately so that, you know, we could hopefully avoid the higher numbers in the South. But, yeah, I think one of the things that struck me so much there was that you always think of HIV and AIDS, as you said, as sort of something that comes with promiscuity and prostitution. And in the village, that wasn't necessarily the case. They were more prudish people. However, there was still plenty of extramarital sex, and mostly the men who had their mistresses and other wives. But also the youth engaged in sex plenty, just in a very covert way. It was never anything I saw any real trace of. But so it was something that needed to be talked about for sure. But again, one thing that I bring up in the book is just that the problem was a lot more complex than just promiscuity. It was a problem that had actually sort of been implicated by, I guess, tradition was implicated in the spread of disease to a certain extent, because there were certain traditions that would facilitate an HIV positive person entering a family that was not HIV positive, that was still healthy. And that was something that was awful to see, because it goes far beyond just, you know, learning to be faithful. It really digs at a way of life that they have practiced for centuries.
Yeah, and we see that in the book when a woman is widowed. Mm-hmm. Her husband has died, and she then becomes the wife of a man in the village, which is good for her. She won't be left alone. She won't be abandoned. But then you gradually realize that her husband probably died of AIDS and that she's infected.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And it's very hard when we read that.
It is so hard.
Insidious.
Yeah, exactly. And it makes you realize what we're up against. It's so much more than just basic fidelity and abstinence. It's so much more than that. Another issue coming into it is just the fatalism that I mentioned before, and the idea that people really do believe in the village that illness is largely related to curses. And if you believe that you have HIV, or that you are HIV positive because somebody put a curse on your family, then why would you ever think to try to act preventatively in the face of it? You know, why would you ever wear a condom, say, if you know or if you believe that AIDS is caused by a curse? One of the sort of interesting ideas that came to me during my time there was that we could have really used sorcery to our own benefit by introducing condoms as a way to ward off a curse instead of a way to ward off a disease, because the disease is really something that they're just used to dealing with. There's always disease. There's always premature death, and it's so often believed to come directly from some bad blood in the village, mm-hmm. so to speak. Some curse by a witch in the village.
Something has gone wrong. Somebody right. hasn't done a sacrifice that they should have done,
exactly.
or they have a vengeful relative, or yeah. And that we see the problems, the complications with preventing AIDS. Even your own, these young men who are your health assistants, mm-hmm. they're very ambivalent about condoms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. One of them in particular, who was so good at teaching people about condoms and about AIDS and at spouting all the statistics about how, 16 or something percent of Abidjan's population was now HIV positive. He was great at all that, but when it came to changing his behavior, not a chance. He told me to my face that he would not use a condom, and that was the most frustrating thing to see. But again, I think it just goes back to the fatalism. He doesn't believe he's going to get it, or if he does, he's going to think it comes from a curse and not because of his own behavior.
Yeah, and of course, one thing that we take for granted here, we kind of all start off taking for granted a long life, especially when we're young.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that isn't the same starting point there for these young men.
No, that's so true. I think people who make it to their 30s and 40s, I believe the life expectancy in Cote d'Ivoire is something in the late 30s, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But so people who make it beyond that are really championed. And I always remember going into new villages or outlying field settlements, and if there was somebody who was remarkably old in the village, they were always the first person I saw. The kids would come running up to me and say, "We've got to show you our old lady. She's 100 years old." And, who knows if she's really 100, because nobody ever kept track of birth dates back in those days. But she was usually a she, first mm-hmm. of all. And she was always hiding in a hut, just a crumbled up old lady with a cane who barely spoke, with roomy eyes. But they were all so proud of her. She reached 100. And, mm-hmm. So age was something that was definitely not taken for granted. It was as I said in the book, women would have 10 kids so that 5 would survive. They just don't plan on having a long life.
Yeah. Well, one thing that's very striking about these people, and certainly mirrors my own experience in Northern Ivory Coast, mm-hmm. is the incredible generosity that they showed towards you. You come there, you list off all these miraculous little things you have, these shortwave radios and these wonderful flashlights and books, and they really have nothing,
mm-hmm.
and yet they are so generous to you.
Yeah, yeah, and that was one of the biggest life lessons I learned there, was just being with the people that really had not much at all. And here I was, a Peace Corps volunteer. Yeah, I wasn't making a huge salary. I just got a stipend of about $200 a month, but on $200 a month, I could have lived like a king there, and they would come and say, "Well, you've got so much stuff," or you're so rich, and you've got this huge house back in Washington, and referring to my parents' house, I'm sure. But I would always try to convince them, no, I'm just as, this is all I have. These were all gifts, which was mostly true. But I would try to convince them so many times that no, in fact, I wasn't that rich. But then, just stepping back and looking at all my stuff and knowing that when I get back to the States, I'm going to get a job. I'll probably buy a house. I might buy a car. Yeah, I was rich. I was definitely rich. And it was very eye-opening to see that despite all that, I was the one who was afraid of being asked for gifts, because it's not part of my social upbringing to be always asked for gifts or to always ask people for gifts. And so the villagers would say when I was leaving to go even on just a one-day trip, they would all say, "Well, bring back this for me." And I would cringe. I would hate it for the first year. And then the second year, it dawned on me that every time I left and came back, there was always a gift for me. Every time anyone else left the village and came back, they always brought a gift for me. They were always giving me things. If I just showed up in a little field settlement to say hello, to give the greetings, they would leave, drop, they would send me off with yams or eggs or something. There was always a gift, and that really was touching and made me sort of reconsider what I always thought was my own generosity, you know.
Right. It was a lot we could learn from there.
Exactly.
Well, you've mentioned that you plan to go back to the States to get a job, and you have all these opportunities when you come back. What was it like coming back to the States after 2 years in a Sanufa village? It must have been quite a culture shock.
Oh, it was. I kind of cheated because I only spent a month in the East, where I'm from, in Washington, D.C., and then I went directly to a little house in the Montana wilderness, and so I was able to escape much of society for the first 3 months that I was here, because I spent that time in the house in Montana writing the book.
Oh.
And so it was a little easier because of that, but I do remember that first month getting back to D.C. and just all of a sudden all the cravings that I had had when I was in Africa disappeared. You know, I had wanted a bagel for 2 years, and now I had a bagel, and yeah, it's okay. You know, so little things like that, and but most of all, I think one of the typical reactions is just being sort of awed at our at the amazing amount of options we have. And one of my Peace Corps friends calls it option paralysis. When you go to, say, a deli and you look at all of the different things you could have on a piece of bread, and it's just coming back from the village where you get rice and sauce, and you might have two choices of sauce, it was just completely... I was stymied at every turn by how much I could choose, but not necessarily in a pleasant way. You know, I kind of wanted things to be given to me or just delivered to me. I didn't want to make all those choices. I just felt like it was a little bit extravagant. And I remember just driving around in the summer in D.C. and seeing all these people out in their convertibles and just thinking, oh, that's probably their second car, and they've got another one home. And it just really makes you look at your own former lifestyle and
yeah.
all the things that you have that you probably don't really need.
And somehow when you're here, you start thinking those choices are important, that it really
yeah.
will matter whether I choose this shampoo or that shampoo.
Right, exactly. And why on earth do we have an entire aisle dedicated to just
right.
shampoo? Yeah,
right.
Exactly. So it was definitely eye-opening. I had done it several times as a Foreign Service kid. I grew up moving overseas at intervals throughout my life. So I definitely had that culture shock before, but coming back from an African village was definitely more extreme than anything I'd known before, and I really missed it. It was hard. It was really hard, especially that first month back. It was extremely hard. I dreamt of my kids every night. Yeah.
Well, they had become like your family, the boys who
Absolutely.
Came to your house every night, and you were teaching them to read and write, and
mm-hmm.
they had become like your nephews or something.
Exactly, yeah. And my friends too.
I mean, they were
kids, but they were kids with a very mature outlook in many ways, and so I would definitely consider these little kids my friends.
Well, you had also spent 2 years acquiring a range of skills.
Mm-hmm.
You had learned languages. You had learned another culture. You had learned all these things about life in a village in Northern Ivory Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And now you brought those things back, and unfortunately, I don't think they're too valuable in this country.
True, but I think below all of it, sort of the pulse that was below everything I learned was just how to rely on my own resources, how to approach people who might not have the same worldview that I have,
mm-hmm.
and how to see things from a different perspective. I think there were a lot of really important lessons that underlay those smaller things that I did learn for immediate results or to get by in my village. And those things, I think, have changed me, for sure. I think a lot more about my actions. I think I am more content with things like waiting. I'm definitely much more patient, having gotten used to the slow pace of life up there.
Yeah.
So I definitely think it has changed me. And I also... just sort of as a tangent to what you were saying, coming back and having all those experiences inside me and being so sort of transformed by them, I think is what really made me write the book.
Mm-hmm.
Because I needed to get it all out. I needed to get it on paper. I needed to explain it, maybe just to myself, but I needed to write it. The stories were sort of bubbling inside me, and I had to get them out. And so I think the way maybe that I've transformed those lessons I learned was to And the way I've used those lessons was to hopefully show them to other people in the book. So.
Well, the book does a wonderful job of that. It's, I think it's hard for me saying because it's such a familiar place to me. But I hope other people who know nothing about Northern Ivory Coast would read it and would find, you know, find this entire world there and travel there with you and learn something about it. Because you really bring it to life beautifully.
Thank you.
Let me just say again to our listeners that you can call in and join Sarah Erdman and me discussing her book Nine Hills, Dinamba Kaha at 333-9455 or at 1-800-222-9455. And this is Carol Spindell sitting in for Celeste Quinn today on the Afternoon Magazine. Now, on September 19th, 2002, a terrible thing happened in Ivory Coast, and there has been civil unrest. There was a coup and an attempted coup, civil unrest, and there has been this division of the country ever since into North and South. And you had already been back for some time. I wasn't sure from your book exactly how long you'd been back when that happened.
About 2 years.
Well, it must be very hard. I mean, had you gone back or had you thought about going back? Or
yeah, I had thought about going back. My villagers told me I could only stay away 2 years and then I'd have to come back. And I've obviously overstayed that. But yeah, it was extremely hard because the immediate effect that it had on my village and my relationship with the village was that it cut off all communication. So there were no phone lines already, anyway, in the village. So that didn't affect us too much. But now the post doesn't work. There's no more postal system in the north, and that was my main line of my main lifeline to the village was writing letters back and forth to my health workers, especially to my health workers and to Sidi Bay. And all of a sudden that disappeared. And so when the book first came out last August in hardback, I was always nervous about those questions. You know, when I would go to speak to audiences, I would hate that question about, you know, have you been in touch with us? Because no, I hadn't. And it was really upsetting for me, but mostly because I knew what it meant to the villagers. I knew that it meant that they were cut off and that their lives had been severely changed by this all.
Yeah, their lives are already so hard, and now they're much harder because of conditions in the north and the unrest and so on. Korogo, the town you mention, and one I've often gone into recently, there were mass graves discovered there. And you mentioned Ivoirite, the idea that maybe we're not all Ivorians. Some of us are better citizens of Ivory Coast than others, and this is unfortunately something that's really damaged a place in which, I don't know, it seems in your book and in my experience, people live of different ethnicities and different religions live together quite harmoniously, side by side.
Absolutely. It was famous for the way that, for its harmony for many, many years. It got independence in 1960, and ever since then it has been a hub for immigrants, and that has helped make it. And in the 70s and 80s, there was a real boom. They did extremely well with coffee and cocoa plantations, especially in the south, and it made Cote d'Ivoire the third largest sub-Saharan African economy. And so it's really sad. I also would have to say that they're not a very warmongering population. They've never had a war. They've never had a real conflict. And so to watch the conflict develop over the time I was there, it was a not necessarily frightening, but just a really sad thing to see. I'm not sure I thought it was going to end like this, and I mean, end is probably the wrong word, but I didn't think it was going to result in sort of a succession, basically, which is what it is right now, a succession.
Well, let me just for a second, let's go to line one, because we have a caller, someone who wants to join our conversation.
Great.
Line one from Champaign.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yes. I just wanted to say that I enjoyed your book immensely. I'm 74 years old, and my wife bought it for me, and she hasn't read it yet, but I sent it to my sister in Phoenix. But I was really impressed with your book, and I think it was very brave of you to go there and work with those people. What were your feelings when you first started out regarding that particular venture?
My feelings when I was still in the States or once I actually arrived there?
Well, both in a sense. You know, what did you feel that you were facing, and what did you feel that you had to, what were your challenges there?
Well, I guess when I was still in the States and just sort of contemplating going, I think what I was looking forward to is actually the challenge of it. I really wanted to kind of start over. Here I had just finished my nice liberal arts education, and I really wanted to see how much was in me, and I wanted to really rely on my own resources. So when I went in pretty much ready for anything. And what I found, I guess, in answer to your question, the first months that I was there, there was quite a bit of culture shock, and I think I wasn't completely prepared for it because I had grown up partly overseas, and so I kind of felt like I had a head start, and that, you know, I'd already done the culture shock thing. But in truth, I had never been to a place that was this third world, that was this not necessarily poor, but they just had such an entirely different culture from my own. From the food they ate, to the clothes they wear, to how they live life, and the fact that life is all outside, that indoors is not part of the equation, really. There was so much that was different that it really just blew me away those first couple weeks. But I guess those were the biggest challenges right off the bat. And then the challenges were more dealing with things like how to teach health education to a society that believes that witches are responsible for disease. And so the challenges kind of went from the immediate sort of tangible ones to the more abstract and challenging ones that really force you to look again at your own perspective and your own ways of solving problems. It really taps into your creativity and your ability to adapt. And so I think those were probably the biggest challenges.
Yes, well, thank you very much for that wonderful book. I enjoyed it immensely, and I'm enjoying your visit here.
Well, thank you so much. That's wonderful to hear. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Well, you're welcome.
All right, we're going to go now to line two. We have someone on a cell phone on line two. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I just wanted to call and say that I have not read the book yet, but I intend to.
Great.
And it struck home with me a common tone because our daughter is in Namibia serving with the Peace Corps. She has an office in Swakopmund on the coast, but moves all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And she had discovered in her way, many things that you've talked about, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to say, obviously, I've said thank you to her for her ability to go over there and serve, and to you and all of the other young people from the United States that are going over there and doing good work in an area that terribly needs help.
Thank you. Yeah, it's actually, I feel, a privilege for us as well to be able to serve and to learn so much about ourselves and about the world. So hopefully everyone benefits in these situations. But that's great. I'm glad to hear your daughter is out there. Namibia is an interesting but tough place to serve as well. So good for her.
Well, she is. She was assigned. She says she feels guilty sometimes, but she was assigned to Swakopmund, which is a more how would you say it? More advanced as mm-hmm. far as creature comforts are concerned, right
mm-hmm.
on the coast. But she moves all over the country from time to time, working on curriculum development.
Mm-hmm.
And she has said, and I'm sure you probably feel the same way, that she has actually received more as far as her personality and her development as a human being than she is giving. So
it's an interesting thing that I think a lot of Peace Corps, former Peace Corps volunteers would say. But I would have to say it's kind of like the image coming to my mind is like a, what is it, an elephant stepping on something as opposed to a high heel stepping on something. I think that you are so so influenced and affected by your entire experience. That's all, the whole experience funneled into just one person. And so, yes, I do think we are changed. We are made better by the experience. But at the same time, you're one person trying to affect a whole community. So it's imbalanced in the first place. But
Sarah, we're going to have to end there.
Oh,
and
sure.
I think that's a good note to end on.
Yeah, okay.
And I want to thank you so much for being with us today on the Afternoon Magazine. It's been great. And I want to say to you for your book, Iniche, Inibada.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
This has been the Afternoon Magazine with Carol Spindell sitting in for Celeste Quinn. Our producer has been Harriet Williamson, Jason Kraft, and Henry Frayne at the controls. Now we're going to have Todd Gleason giving the settlement report.
That's correct. How are you this afternoon? Doing very well. Nice show, by the way. Let's take a look at what's happening at the Chicago Board of Trade. At the end of this Friday afternoon, trade settled like this in the wheat pit. December futures, 327.5, the high, the low at 321. A settlement price there at 321.75. They were down 3.5 cents at the end of the day. The March contract at 338, high, low at 332.5. Settled at 334, down 2.5 cents. And the May wheat, 341.5, the high, the low at 337.5. Settlement price at 338, down 2.25. July contract, 345.5, high, low at 341. Settled 341.25, down 2.25. And the September wheat, 350, the high, the low at 346. The settlement price at 347. That was down 2 for the day. From the corn pit, futures finished like this in the December contract, 207.5. That's 207.5 for the high. Low at 205, settlement price at 205.25, down 2.5 cents. The March futures, 217.75 high, low at 216. Settled 216.25, down 2. And the May futures, 224.5 high, low at 222.5. Settled at 222.75, down 2.25. July contract now, 230.5 high, low at 228.75. Settlement price at 229 for the July corn, down 2 cents. And September futures, 236.75 high, low at 235. Settled 235. They were off a penny and 3/4 for the day. December contract for next year in the corn pit, 243 the high, the low at 242. Settled 242.25. They were off 1.5 for the day. December oats, 165.25 high, low at 160, settled 164.5, down 4.5 cents. The March contract at 171 high, low at 165.75, settled there at 170. They were off 4.25 for the day. November beans now, 535 the high, the low at 523, settled 523.5. The November beans, down 14.25 cents for the day. January futures, 543 high, low at 531. Settled 531.25, down 14.25. March contract, 550.5 high, low at 539. Settled 539.5, down 14 cents. And the May soybeans, a 558 high, low at 546. Settled 546.75, off 13.5 cents. July futures, 564 the high, the low at 553.5, settled 553.75, down 12.25. And the August contract at 558 high, low at 553.5, settled 553.5, down on that low, 12.5 cents lower for next year's August bean contract. October bean meal and the rest of the complex, 159 the high, low at 156.50, settled at 156.90. They were down 2.50 for the day. And December bean meal, 161.50 for the high. The low at 159.20. Settlement price there at 159.30. They were down 2.80. October bean oil, 21.52 the high. The low at 20.75. Settled 20.78. Down 78. And December futures, 21.38 for the high. The low at 20.65. December soybean oil settled today at 20.68. They were off 83 at the end of the trade. Now from the Mercantile Exchange, we'll take a look at the numbers. Jay Pierce is in. Good afternoon to you, Jay.
Well, good afternoon, Todd. Thank you very much. September feeder cattle ended the day up 32.5. The high price, 115.20. The low, 114.80. And the settlement, 115.15. Again, up 32.5. October feeder cattle, 112.50 was the high. The low was 111.80. The settlement, 112.12.5. 112.12.5. And that was down 52.5. November, 111.45 was the high. 110.70 was the low. 110.90 was the settlement, down 55. October live cattle had a high today of 85.05, a low of 84.30. The settlement, 84.47.5, down 60. December live cattle, 87.45 was the high. The low was 86.52.5. The settlement, 86.97.5, down 50. October lean hogs had a high of 77.85, a low of 76.25. The settlement, 76.42.5, up 27.5. December lean hogs, the high 71.80, the low 70.60. The settlement, 70.82.5, down 37.5. February lean hogs, the high 68.62.5, the low 67.50. The settlement, 67.85, down 80. And April 05 lean hogs, the high 66.60, the low 65.40. The settlement, 65.92.5, down 72.5. And the frozen pork belly contract for February, the high today, 104.50. The low was $100.40 a hundredweight. The settlement at $100.50, down at 287.5. And Todd, that's how things closed up on the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you very much, Jay. Hey, an interesting show coming up this afternoon during the closing market report. We'll take up the subject of LDP again today when we talk with Mike Zuzulo, Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, in Lafayette, Indiana this afternoon. That happening at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock in Champaign County today. The LDP for corn at 34 cents. And we spoke a little bit with Mike this morning, or at least Dave Dickey did, during the opening market report about what he thinks you should do, whether you should take that LDP or wait. We'll ask him again just exactly what his plans for LDP and harvested corn might be over the weekend, given what looks to be like a pretty good outlook for that program.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Annie O'Keefe from Webster Groves, Missouri writes, "Dear Dr. Science, what colors attract a child's attention most? Do some colors encourage learning better than others?"
You are one lucky woman, especially if you plan on raising a family with this man. His intense desire to both parent and nurture has found expression in a physical protuberance, no matter how small. As a child, he may have been deeply influenced by the Dr. Seuss book, Horton Hatches an Egg. I know I was. That irresponsible Maisie Bird colored my whole view of women, and may be responsible for the fact that I live alone today. I once heard about a man who sported 8 nipples, but most of them were found to be rubber suction cups. He used them as a conversation starter at parties.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath. To order the Dr. Science Smug Pack with I Know More Than You Do mug, t-shirt and tape, $29.